Welcome to the official Tennis.com podcast, featuring professional coach and community leader, Kamal Murray.
Welcome, everybody. This is the Tennis.com podcast. I am your host, Kamal Murray, and today we have the pleasure of being with Danny Valverdeaux. Most of you all know him from his days being on the coaching teams of Roger and Stan Wawrinka and Pliskova, but now he's taking on a new venture, being a tournament director and getting his feet wet, that, you know, like I am in Chicago, buying towels, buying water, setting up the site, you know, all hands on deck kind of mentality. So today he and I are going to chop it up and just talk about, you know, obviously experience on tour, and then, you know, sort of the state of tennis and the tournaments and how these events came about. So Danny, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Kamal. It's a pleasure being here. And yeah, we're sharing some experiences at the moment, a little bit different from our professional on-tour life that we've been dealing for the last few years. But yeah, it's exciting. I'm having a great time. We've only had actually five and a half weeks to deliver the event, so it's been a lot of work. But San Diego, I think the weather here makes it all worth it. So we're looking forward to the event.
Well, you couldn't be in a better location because you're right near Indian Wells. So you, I mean, literally people can drive from one tournament to the next. You know, mine, they got to take a nice little flight, you know. Yeah. Palm Springs Airport is real small.
Yeah, the timing and the week in the schedule obviously helps. I mean, we got a great feel, but that has to do with being right before Indian Wells and being 2 hours away, so it makes sense for the player flow. And yeah, we got very lucky with being allowed to be on this week, and also for the players. I think it works for them as well. So no, we're privileged to be right before the big event coming in 10 days time.
Well, you know what's funny is I think, you know, part of your advantage, my advantage of having been on the tour and understanding how to make a schedule for a player sort of helps us in terms of planning out which weeks to do an event, right? Where to do it, how to make it comfortable for the players, you know, because originally our event in Chicago was a 125. And, you know, before it got upgraded to a 500, I was confident that in this year, with a COVID year and people being short on minimum play requirements and all the things that come, you know, being a coach, I was sure we're going to get a great feel at a good price, you know. What was your logic in picking, you know, a San Diego for a location in that week?
No, you hit the nail on the head. When the opportunity came up, when the Asian tournaments got canceled and the ATP was looking for events, I knew there was a group here in San Diego that had been interested for a long time to get a hold of an event. They had never had an ATP event here in San Diego, so I thought it'd be the perfect match. So I contacted them. We put up a proposal, sent it to the ATP, and they approved it. But again, you said it already. From my side, I thought, look, week 39, right before Indian Wells, not much going on in Europe, perfect weather, 2 hours away by car. I think we're going to get a great feel. So that's what I told my group here in San Diego. I said, look, it's a no-brainer, especially being allowed fans here in San Diego makes a difference financially for the event to be healthy. So we're allowed 100% capacity, which makes a major difference, especially in a city that has never had an event. So it's new, and I knew that it was going to be successful. So from my side, knowing that we were going to have a great player field, I told the guys, look, if there's a time to do it, it's right now. So it's working out well.
And you know, it's funny. So like, you knew you were going to have a good player field. I knew I was going to have a good player field, but sometimes the sponsors don't understand that, you know, because the deadline isn't until 6 weeks before. And even this one, our deadline was like 3 weeks before. Exactly. Right. And so sponsors like, well, who's coming? And I'm like, well, everybody's going to come. And they're like, yeah, but how do you know? And I'm like, I just know. You know what I mean? I just know. Did you get some of that? And people are like, well, I want to know who's coming. I'm like, well, deadline's not till this time, but trust me, they're coming. It was a lot of like, was it a lot of trust in sort of your team, your sponsors, and in you and the fact that you knew? Because it wasn't a lot. It's hard to just say this person.
Even my group, I mean, when we had our first couple meetings, that was the biggest selling point. I said, look, you're going to have a great field. And I said, so who's coming? I'm like, I can't tell you who's coming, but I'm pretty sure that we're going to have a great field. So with sponsors, what we try to do before the list came out, we guaranteed some walkers already with a couple of big names. We had Kay and Andy commit to the walkers. So that's obviously, that was the first step for us to go to the sponsors to and tell them, look, we have already a three-time slam champion, X number one. We have Kei Nishikori, big in the Japanese community. Obviously in California, that's a good match. So we had a good start with those two walkers. And then obviously when the list came out and we were the second strongest 250 of the year following Doha, then that also helped to close some deals.
Well, that's interesting because when I look at, let's say, obviously Andy Murray needs a wild card. Like we gave a wild card to Kim Clijsters, right? So based on their ranking, they need a wild card. But somebody like Kei Nishikori would have got in on his own. And yeah. You sort of, I mean, you know, somebody could say, well, you wasted a wild card on somebody that would have got in anyway.
No, but right? He's actually out. He still wouldn't. The cutoff was 42 and his current ranking is, I think, 50 something. Obviously, he was injured for a couple of years or a year and a half. So he's starting to build back up. So he needed the walker. Otherwise, he would be playing qualis.
That's crazy that a cutoff of 42 for a 250.
Yeah, we have eight top 20 players, I think 13 or 14 top 30 players. And then, yeah, the final cutoff was 42. I think now it moved to maybe 44 or 45 because David Goffin pulled out. He's out for the year. And I forgot, actually, we had a guaranteed wildcard with Dominic Thiem at the beginning before he pulled out for the whole year. So that was also a good selling point with the sponsors. But then, unfortunately, he got injured again and he's out for the year. So we had to cancel that one.
Yeah. So let me ask you this, because, you know, in Chicago, it hasn't been any pro tennis here for a long time. And it's like third or fourth largest city in the world or in America, big tennis community. We've got like three USTA presidents. Three of the past four or five USTA presidents have been from Chicago, and we don't have a pro event. San Diego, Barnes Tennis Center, the home of the girls 16s and 18s Super Nationals,
yeah.
Right? How is it that a city with that weather, with that facility, and that sort of reputation, or like just Super Nationals, girls 18s, where you win the wild card and go to the US Open, how is it that city did not have an event already?
Yeah, that's a good question. The biggest tennis event they've had here are Davis Cups. So they had the one against the UK maybe 8 years ago that they played at the Padre Stadium. And then I think back in the day at La Jolla Beach Club, they had a Davis Cup tie there as well. So the group that helped organize the Davis Cup at the Padre Stadium with the USTA, they were the ones that were interested to bring an event, but they just couldn't get a hold of one. It's not easy to get a hold of a license there. It's not from the ATP side. The ATP doesn't create new licenses. So you have to go to a current license owner, so an event that is already running and make them an offer and buy their week and their license. So it's not easy. There's a certain amount of licenses out there for the 250s, 500s and thousands. I think the 250 ones are more accessible than the 500s and the thousands, but still, maybe one or two sell a year, and there is a lot of people that are interested in them. So there's not that much supply and a lot of demand. So it's not easy. So when I went to the group here, they said, look, we've been trying for a while, but we were not successful with trying to get one. So this is like a step in the door. You know, I said, look, take this 1 year license, let's deliver a nice event, make the players happy, make it fun for the fans. And hopefully, after this year, we can go to a current license owner and hopefully we can buy one to keep it here permanently.
Yeah, man, I think that is one of the things that in this journey is just so shocking, that a sport like tennis that is like real small. When you think about tennis in America, right? Tennis in the global, you got soccer, you got tennis. You know, we're big, I think, globally. But in America, we're like six or seven behind, you know, basketball, football, baseball. You know what I mean? Yeah.
Field hockey, probably.
Yeah, I know, right? Hockey. It's baffling to me on how hard it is to create an event, right? If, you know, we want to grow as a sport, America's a big market. You know what I mean? Like, of the four slams, U.S. Open is the Super Bowl.
Yeah.
You know, just from a, you know, what is the U.S. Open title translate into marketing dollars? It's more than Australia, right? It's more than the French Open. Yeah. And so how is it that we can't A, create new sanctions in order to grow the sport in America, or B, some of the dormant sanctions, you know, sort of create like a negotiating platform. We can just activate them so that the entire sport can grow.
I think, I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, but in the US, in the 80s, 90s, and early 2000s, you had more events in the US, I think. Yeah. You still have some more now, but not at flagship locations, like you said, San Diego, Chicago. It's just a shame that there are not more of those cities having the big events. It's also a shame that the event in LA went away for the guys, the ATP 250 that they had in Los Angeles. Hopefully, San Diego can be the California 250 now. So that would be the goal. And I agree. I mean, it's a shame that there's not more. I think there's a lot of interest. It's just not easy to get a hold of it. And hopefully between you and I can bring tennis back to the US.
So let me ask you this. You know, you and I, we're used to walking into the venue, everything set up, towels are plentiful. So coffee, you drink a half bottle of water, you throw it away, and you get another bottle of water, and you do a half drink.
I'm going to make sure I finish this bottle. Now I'll make sure I finish this bottle. Back in the day, I would have two sips and throw it away.
Right.
Yeah, now I finish it.
I mean, you know, like our last event, every night we would clean up, and I'd see like, you know, a third, when a water bottle is drink a third, and I see people grab a new one. I'm like, no, man, I got to pay for that water. Drink the rest of that water. So, you know, how is it for you now? Look, all behind the scenes, watching every penny, you know, because the trick is you want to got a first year event, but you can't lose your shirt on, you know, little things like with, you know, 5,000 bottles of water, right? Can sort of make the event lose money. And then your team, your sponsor's like, yeah, you know, Danny, that was fun, but we're not in the business of having a party and losing money.
Exactly. So even, I mean, there are two situations today. The first one, some players started arriving today, so we had to get the towels. So, but the deal that we got with the hotel is that we have to return the towels. So usually, I mean, I take probably 10 towels to the court, leave three on court, two in the locker room. I probably have two in the players' lounge. So then I saw some of the guys, like, where are the towels? He's like, I told you to bring them back. He's like, come on, Danny. Really? He's like, yeah, please bring the towels back. You know? And they're like, and then I was looking around, like, wow, where are the sports drinks? I was like, well, so we're planning to have them tomorrow on Thursday, two days before the event starts. But we have a couple guys here, and they asked me for sports drinks. I'm like, oh, so I ended up going to the nearest supermarket, getting in my car, putting a bunch of Gatorades in the trunk, and then driving them back. So things that I obviously would have never done before. But yeah, I agree. But I think I look at things differently than I used to, especially when it comes down to cost. So it's definitely been an eye opener, but a good one in a way. I think it's important to understand both sides of the game, to understand how hard people work to make events happen. I've been now part of the player council for a long time, so I understand this side of the coin quite well. But actually running one firsthand, it's giving me a closer look, and I really appreciate all the events and the effort that they put.
Yeah, man, I would tell you. So we had our laundry service. Sorry to people on why listen to the podcast to bore you with laundry conversations, but this is how real it gets. So we had our laundry service, right? We, you know, they pick up by two, drop off by two.
Yeah.
So whatever towels that are used after 2 o'clock and left at 10, 11 o'clock, you got to make sure there's enough to cover between 8 a.m. and 1:50 when towels are back. So our entire 250, brother, I was taking home garbage bags full of towels.
Washing them.
So that we wouldn't run out before the laundry guy dropped off the next day. So it's a newfound appreciation.
Even now, we just finished setting up the whole players' lounge. The team did a great job. And then I'm looking around and I'm like, we have no plugs. Where are people going to charge their phones? It's like, so I got to go now to the shop and buy the extensions to make sure that players have plugs to charge their phones. So, I mean, things that they're usually there. I'm having to, obviously, 2 days before the event, you start to micromanage and trying to make sure that everything's working. It's been an experience, especially delivering it with only 5 weeks. That's been the big challenge. I was in Europe for the first 3 weeks. So with the time difference, that wasn't ideal. But now, yeah, it's good to be on site, and I think everything's good to go. Players are arriving, which I think that's the nicest feeling, to be honest. That's what I've liked the most. It's been a challenge to set everything up, but having the guys arrive, you know, seeing them on court playing, I mean, that's what we do, you know, so that's what definitely makes me the happiest.
Yeah, you know, I think that it's good to see them in a different light. It's good to sort of be on this front line and then honestly make changes, because now you've been on both sides of the ball and now you can say, hey, look, as an organizer, this needs to change.
Yeah.
Right, for the player. You know, if this model is going to be sustainable, we need to do X, Y, and Z, right? Because, you know, the 250s, even though it's a 250 and you get, you know, you get top 20s, you got top 20 wild cards, et cetera, still hard to make money doing it, right? Especially with COVID, you know, you kind of never know how many people are going to come out. Are they still skittish about being there? So, you know, definitely a newfound appreciation. And I got a notepad full of notes and suggestions that I plan to send to the CEO just to make the business model better.
How to make the 250 sustainable?
Yes, I
agree. I think the 250 model has been not struggling, but hasn't been easy for at least half of the 250s in the ATP. They're still there grinding, trying to make it happen, but it's not easy. So if we can find a way to improve that model, I think that's a plus. So I agree with you. I think the more we can share after this experience and trying to improve the model, the better. Even it will be even better for the players. I think long term we've had to make it sustainable.
So let me ask you this. After our 250, the week before the U.S. Open, I didn't want to go to U.S. Open. I was like, I'm tired. I don't want to see another tennis ball. I don't want to see another WTA player. I just want to break. Yeah. After next week, do you think you're going to Indian Wells or are you going to sit it out?
I have to fly back home. Before my wife will kill me otherwise. But if I had the chance, I would sit it out. I would sit it out. I was actually in New York for 4 days at the beginning of the Open for some ATP stuff. And I had just been in San Diego working the full week trying to set everything up before going to New York. And I didn't go. I only watched one match. I went to watch Andy playing on center against Tsitsipas. So I thought that would be a nice one to watch. But I sat it out. I think you need it after running these events, you need a bit of a break from tennis.
Yeah. That's real cool. So let me ask you this.
Are you gonna go to Indian Wells?
I gotta go for one day. Gotta do some filming for SAP.
Okay.
But my plan is to be in and out.
In and out.
this is our third event, you know. So I had, you know, two events, then a couple weeks break, and then now 500, and you know, players are starting to arrive early. And like you said, they get here today. The sports drinks don't arrive till tomorrow. So
I don't know how it is for you. The one thing that I found very difficult is I start freaking out about things because I know, like, when I come as a coach, the things that are important to me, which usually for a tournament director that hasn't been a coach, maybe those things don't bother him. Like, I can't sleep at night sometimes. Like, I'm thinking, like, what if someone's on the court now, you know? Like, because a public center is like, what if they spill a Gatorade on the court, you know? So at 3 a.m, I wake up thinking, can you imagine if I arrive tomorrow on site and the court is ruined, you know? So I arrived in the morning, first thing I did, went to the court, checked all the lines, make sure the surface was nice, put like yellow tape around the court to make sure that no one came in. So I was like, I came in with a leaf blower to make sure like the court was perfect. Yeah. Because I know, I mean, that's what I look at when I come as a coach, making sure the net was like tied perfectly, you know, like all those small details that I think are time consuming and they're stressing me out more than anything. Plus all the other stuff on top. But I'm like the details from the player side, I'm even more thorough than probably another tournament director would be, which I guess is a good thing for the guys, and that helps them as well. Even today, like, we have no bananas. Like, I got to go to the supermarket, get them bananas.
Oh, yeah. we did two of those last time. The supermarket run to go get a box of bananas.
Yeah.
So speaking of those details, do you remember a couple of years ago at the Open, you and your player were using court 5? After us.
Okay.
You remember what you did?
Single sticks, maybe?
Yeah, single sticks.
Single sticks.
You walked on the court and you were like, you didn't put the single sticks up? And I'm like, nah, bro, we don't hit flat. Like, you know what I mean? You know, so I thought about it because you talked about those details, you know, like as a coach, the things that, you know, the court matters, you know, nobody spill Gatorade because Gatorade stains the court. You know, so the single sticks.
The single sticks today for the ATP net, the one that's branded, they have special single sticks that have a rubber base. So there's one rubber base for each stick. So I told the maintenance guy, I said, if we lose this rubber base, we're in trouble. He's like, you have to make sure this rubber base, we only have one of each. So I said, because the ATP sends you like, we have two match courts, so we only have two nets with two single sticks, two rubber bases per net. So I said, make sure they're locked at night, because if we lose these things, single sticks are not going to work. He's like, it's key for me. So I mean, like those details, that's another example of like, maybe keeps me busier because I'm looking at those details like maybe another tournament director wouldn't be worrying about it too much.
Yeah, and you know, I remember that day. I was like, it was, you know, when you think about the coaching aspect, the details that matter to your player. Like that at that time, you were coaching the player that hits through the court, super flat, yeah, right? You know, 6 inches over the net, right, and can hit your bonus into the net, right? So you're like, oh, let me put the single sticks up, right? You know, exactly. But for me, I was like, oh no, we clear the net, bro. We're fine. we like 4 or 5 feet. We don't need those single sticks. We're not even hitting that close to the net. But I mean, like those details, you're right, where, you know, we're less worried about the bananas, but we're very worried about having a practice course nice and tight, making sure we got indoor backup, you know, because if a coach, the pet peeve is a coach calling, trying to get a practice court, can't get a practice court, or it rains, you know, those things matter to me, where it's like, I hate bananas, so I don't even think about it.
Yeah. So I'm also quite anal about practice and practice course and practice court booking. So we have someone in charge of practice course, but I'm like messaging them like every 5 minutes, who's booked? Where'd you put them? Send me the sheet. Like, let me look it over. like I want to make sure like the whole practice schedule is like perfect, which usually a tournament director, like you're not worrying about that stuff.
Yeah.
But again, I mean, I guess that's a plus for the players and a plus for the event, that we're quite thorough. I want to make, I mean, we're player guys. We want to make them happy and want to make sure that they get what they get what they want. So yeah, it's a change, but a fun one. I'm having a good time.
Well, let me ask you this. One of the biggest learning curves for me was the TV deal and negotiating the TV deal and the streaming rights and all of that kind of stuff. No. Did you have somebody that worked on that for you, or did you sort of do that yourself?
I did it with the ATP. I did it domestically, and internationally the ATP deal with that. So I had to deal with the domestic broadcasters. And that was also new. But I mean, I had a relationship with the people working for both stations. So that was a plus as well. But it was new territory. Interesting to find out a few things and how it works also with data, quite interesting as well. I'm happy that we're sharing Tennis Channel. We had some conversations, the two of us, about, I mean, I was on your case trying to get your MSP, your schedule of matches, to try and make sure we were not clashing. You know, I wanted to make sure that if you had a good match and I had a good match, we were not playing at the same time. So Tennis Channel could broadcast both matches.
Yeah. And we were trying to figure out the light situation, because we obviously got 64 draws, you got 32 draw. So we were like, okay, we got to, you know, we're going to have to play into the night, you know, so we got to bring in some temporary lights before we narrow down the MSP, you know. And I was a coach, I had no idea what MSP stood for. Now it's like, I wake up in the middle of my night with a nightmare about MSP.
And I was not finalizing hours, because I said, look, I have to wait in Chicago. I want to make sure that we're not clashing, especially towards the weekend. For the semifinals and the finals, I don't want them playing at the same time. I want them to have their airtime, show their final, and then we can play afterwards. I mean, the two-hour time difference helps. Yeah. But I had all the international broadcasters like, can you send me the MSP? Can you? And I was like, no, I'm waiting in Chicago. Just give me a week, you know? It's like, wait.
And we were trying to figure out the lights.
Yeah. we also had to work with the lights. They have great lighting here at the Barnes Tennis Center, so that helped. So we're actually doing two sessions, a day and a night session. But we had to improve them. So we had the ATP visit, and they suggested that we improve them a little bit. So we had to deal with that too. But now they're great. We got lucky that we had permanent lights here. So that helped us, because then we can do, especially during the week, not for the weekend, but we're doing two sessions, which is good for ticket revenue, because you sell double the seats. Mm-hmm. So that definitely helped us.
But I think, you know, that's sort of collaboration is what this sport needs. You know, when I look at sort of ATP, WTA, tournament organizers, you know, I think that sometimes they view it as competition. right? Not in, and it should be viewed as cooperation, right? Because we are still a small sport, particularly in America. We need to grow. The only way we do it is together, right? And so, you know, it was refreshing to work with somebody like, yo, when are you gonna schedule your matches? You know, let's make sure we, you know, you get your tournament, get the airtime, get my tournament, not just like, well, hey, I'm scheduling mine. You know, the men's tournament is probably gonna get TV priority, right? And the women, you're gonna take a back seat. So it was refreshing, and that attitude is
from my side, I was thinking, look, big event, big WTA event in America. You're gonna have a lot of Americans playing. Also some big names coming from abroad. You're going to have some big matches in the semifinals and the finals. And especially if there's some American players playing the event in the States, they're going to want to show that. So let's try and make it flexible for everyone, you know? I thought it would be just such a shame that we have a good match here. You have a big match in Chicago, and then they have to pick and choose. Like, why do that, you know? So I agree. I think collaboration is key, especially for a sport like ours, in the U.S., which we have to go all together, try and be as strong as we can, and hopefully, I mean, that's something that maybe we can talk about it offline. But hopefully, WTA and the ATP they'll figure something out, and I think we'll be a stronger product together. We'll have more leverage with everyone, with sponsors, because it'll be just one product. So it's either you buy this product or there is nothing else. Right. So I think it's going to help us. Both from both sides. So I agree. I think collaboration is the key for us, especially in the U.S.
So let me ask you this. You brought up your wife, right? And, you know, you and I in the same situation. Do you get like the side eye when you get home after doing this for a couple of weeks and not sleeping and coming home late and, not being present for the kids and everything? Do you get the attitude?
I got the attitude as soon as I told her that I had to leave for 3 weeks. I mean, she's used to it. We've been together 10 years and she met me as a coach. So I was on the road with Andy at the time. I was on the road almost 40 weeks a year. So, I mean, she knew what she was getting into. But now for the last years, we have 2-year-old twins at home. So now it's a different story. She's not as happy when I leave. Obviously, she needs a bit of help at home, but she understands. She's extremely supportive, so I'm very lucky to have her. But definitely the first few days when I'm back there, not the easiest ones.
Yeah. She's like, she's waiting at the door with you with both kids. Like, here, your turn.
There you go. They're yours now.
Right. Well, let me ask you, though, because, you know, you and I have similar positions. Like, I started coaching before I had kids, and you could basically travel unlimited. And now you got kids, it's sort of a different consideration. Do you limit your weeks on the road when you're coaching? Or is it still, you know what, I got to be gone 40 weeks a year. That just is what it is. Or do you pick and choose? Because I found it where, you know, the past couple of years, I started to say, I'm going to skip this tournament. I'm going to skip that tournament, not available this week, that kind of thing. What do you think?
Yeah, so before kids, I was very flexible. I mean, I started coaching. I was privileged to start very young. So I was super flexible, let's say, the first 10 years. But then when the kids were born, it all changed. Not easy to leave, not easy to be on the road 5-6 weeks nonstop. So I definitely started to pick and choose what I did. So when the kids were born, I was sharing the coaching job with Magnus. So we were doing 50-50 with Stan. So that worked out really well. And then the pandemic hit. So actually that worked out pretty well in a way, you know, but at least so I could spend time with the kids. Yeah. So that was nice. Obviously not having work. It's not ideal for all of us. That didn't help tennis or sports or anybody in general, but at least I got to spend time at home with the children. So I haven't traveled much actually since they were born. But moving forward, I will definitely limit the weeks on the road. I won't be doing 35, 40 weeks anymore. That's not happening.
Well, I'm with you. Well, man, I know, man, you and I both, you know, these are crazy weeks for us. I want to thank you for taking the time out to chat. You know, commiserate, share experiences. It's new territory for both. But man, I wish you luck. I'm gonna definitely see you soon back on the road with the player. I'm gonna walk off the court with no single sticks, and you're gonna put them up. You know. But man, I want to just thanks for coming on the show. This is the tennis.com podcast. I am your host, Kamal Murray, and we have just had some good insight from the other side of the ball, the promoter side of the ball, from Danny Valverde, who's running ATP 250 next week, opposite, you know, our WTA 500. So thank you all for joining us. Danny, thanks so much, man. If you need to call me late at night and just yell at the phone, I'll pick up and listen.
You'll get a couple of those calls this week. But thank you, Kamau. All the best in Chicago. And I'll be watching on Tennis Channel.